Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for a discussion on the current market environment. My name is Ed Kelly. I'm the Chief Sales Officer at Brinker Capital. And today, you're going to hear from Jeff Raup, our Chief Investment Officer, Tim Holland, our Global Investment Strategist, and Dr. Daniel Crosby, our Chief Behavioral Officer. Jeff's going to start the call off by reviewing the recent market activity. Tim will then provide an update on our positioning and our thinking. And then finally, Dr. Crosby will provide tips on reacting to the market environment. I will now turn the call over to Jeff to start the call.
Okay, thanks, Ed, and thanks everybody for attending today's call. I'll focus on what we know with four main topics: the markets, coronavirus, the price war in oil, and the presidential election. First with the market. So after today's action, the year-to-date return for the S&P 500 is down about 15%. International developed down about 17%, emerging markets down about 16%. The good news is diversification has been able to moderate some of that volatility, with fixed income up mid-single digits on a year-to-date basis, and those accounts that are more conservative and moderate benefiting from that. So until we have some degree of confidence that the coronavirus is contained, the outbreak will remain the primary driver of short-term market sentiment. And we saw this earlier when the outbreak started in China in late January. The market sold off as cases accelerated and fully recovered 2 weeks later when infection rates began to decline, obviously before really the spread beyond China started. At this point, we can't gauge the trajectory of the outbreak, but market action in the last 2 weeks has started to price in a significant drop in GDP and corporate earnings for the first and the second quarter of this year. So if you look at it, recession odds have increased and depend greatly on the longevity of measures to contain the virus. This last 1 or 2 months will probably avoid recession. Economic numbers, if you look, coming into the crisis, were very strong and accelerating, as evidenced by even just last week's employment report. And while it's a scary environment, the investment philosophy that we have has lasted through environments like this in the past, and it will this time. That's why we diversify. In times like this, we look through the noise and find the opportunities that will be realized when we get through this. So now on coronavirus, I'll just touch on a few points that I think are important, as there's a lot being reported that needs some careful analysis before drawing conclusions. So if you look, as of this afternoon, there were 113,000 reported cases globally, with over 80,000 coming from China. While the growth rate of the virus in China has fallen substantially, expectations are that growth outside of China will increase as testing ramps up. That and the economic impact of combating the spread are the reality that markets are coming to grips with right now. Most controversial is the mortality rates of the virus. While the reported averages are about 2 to 3%, there's growing thought that it will end up much lower. As an example, in the fall of 2009, the World Health Organization estimated that the lethality of swine flu was 1 to 1.3% during the outbreak. 4 years later, they did a look back study and determined that the actual mortality rate was just 0.02%, with the difference being that the vast majority of people that caught the swine flu never showed symptoms and were never measured in part of the original measurements. And we think that that's really the case that we see right now. At this point in time, South Korea has conducted the most widespread testing, and its mortality rate is about 0.7%, which is well below the global average. And I think that gives a better indication of where we may finally end up. My final point has been well reported on. Mortality rates differ greatly by age and by health, and with those having compromised lung capacity most at risk. Understanding this should help increase the effectiveness of our response and further reduce mortality rates. So in short, we think the virus will be more pervasive than previously thought, but much less lethal than currently reported. So now the price war in oil. So this really occurred over the weekend, exacerbating the uncertainty of the virus, was this weekend's announcement that OPEC, the OPEC production alliance collapsed, resulting in Saudi Arabia slashing oil prices and threatening to increase production. So while lower, we've talked about this before, while lower oil prices long-term can be good for consumers and the economy, the shock of the 25% decline in the price of oil just adds another degree of uncertainty to what is already a shaky market, and it provides a headwind to U.S. manufacturing CapEx while this price war lasts. So really just, as I mentioned, something that added to the uncertainty around the virus really, I think, was the driver of the action that we saw today. And the last thing I'll touch on before turning it over to Tim is the presidential election, which I never would have predicted could be overshadowed at this point in the year. So the big thing here is that post-Super Tuesday, Joe Biden is now the overwhelming Democratic favorite. And on Wednesday of last week, we saw a significant market reaction to the upside. This is important from a market perspective, as we view President Trump's reelection as highly dependent on the strength of the economy. And a virus-weakened economy raises the odds of a Democratic win in November. So while this dynamic has receded some from the headlines, it remains something that we feel is very important and is an important part of our outlook. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tim for our thoughts moving forward. Tim?
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. I'd like to spend the next few minutes speaking to where we think the economy and the markets go from here and what might prove particularly supportive to both as we move further into 2020. Clearly, risk assets have corrected sharply, and we do think the economy is in for some tough sledding near term. And we should all expect the news on the economic front and the news concerning the coronavirus to get worse before it gets better. However, we do think much of the bad news we've already gotten and much of the bad news to come has likely already been priced into the markets. If you consider the sharp drawdown in stocks, and the very meaningful rally in haven assets like U.S. government bonds, excuse me. And while we do expect some tough news on the economy and the economy to slow, a recession is still not our base case. We don't think a recession is inevitable. And were we to get to a recession, we do think it would be short and shallow, as we just don't see much in the way of economic excess that would need to be addressed or worked off. If you think about prior downturns, including the Great Recession of about 12 years ago, they have historically been preceded by or caused by too aggressive monetary policy by the Federal Reserve, raising rates too far too fast, or the bursting of a financial bubble like the housing market 12 or 13 years ago, or a spike in oil prices, which also happened about 12 or 13 years ago. We are clearly not dealing or confronted with any of those factors today. Instead, we are dealing with the impact of a virus first on the supply side. If you think about the recent disruption of supply chains and production, obviously, particularly in China, and now the impact of a virus on the demand side, as evidenced by fewer Americans feeling comfortable getting on planes and taking trips today due to worries over the coronavirus. So to a certain extent, we are in uncharted waters economically. That said, if we think about the economy and the markets and what might help both over the coming months, a good place to begin is the actual word help, which we think can serve as a reasonable acronym for four very positive data points that we think are worth paying attention to. H would be for housing, E is equities relative to bonds or fixed income, L is liquidity, and P for policy, which gets you the word help. So first with housing, the U.S. housing market remains in very good shape. Values are at an all-time high, though affordability isn't an issue the way it was 13 or 14 years ago towards the end of that housing cycle. And the cost to own a home or refinance an existing mortgage continues to come in as rates come down dramatically. And unlike the mid-2000s, again, there's no sign of a bubble or an affordability gap. And for most Americans, as unpleasant as the recent stock market performance is, For most Americans, their home is by far their most significant asset. And simply put, if housing can hang in there, the consumer should be able to hang in there. And if the U.S. consumer can hang in there, the economy can weather this current storm. If we all remember that consumption is about 70% of our $21 to $22 trillion in annual GDP. And should we see a meaningful spike in refinancing activity over the coming months, and we think we will, all of that should put more cash into the average American's pocket and thus support consumer sentiment and spending at a particularly important time. So E would be, again, for equities relative to bonds or fixed income. And right now, even though markets, the stock market has been under pressure and has come in a bit, equities are very attractively priced relative to fixed income. One data point we would call everyone's attention to is that the dividend yield on the S&P 500 is markedly higher than the yield on the U.S. 10-year note. So the dividend yield on the S&P 500 is about 2.1%, whereas the yield on the 10-year U.S. Note is about 0.5%, half a percentage point, which is a record spread of about 1.6%. This is exceptionally rare. That type of difference in the dividend yield relative to the U.S. 10-year yield has only happened a few other times over the past 20 years, and only anywhere near to the current extent during the worst of the Great Recession, and the period in time when stocks were selling off precipitously and bonds were rallying sharply as people were very worried about the outlook for the economy and the markets. That also happened to mark the point in time where the market was bottoming and was about to turn higher. So if history is any guide, stocks are not only a much better bet than bonds going forward, but the stock market is at or near a bottom. Moving on to L and liquidity. Fortunately, as of today, liquidity is not an issue for the markets. Yes, risk assets are selling off sharply, but equity and fixed income markets are not seizing up as they did in 2008. More importantly, while spreads have been widening within the high yield market, think more levered companies, as investors sell the bonds of more levered companies, most of that pain seems contained within the energy sector. And Jeff talked about the dramatic drawdown in oil prices. So for now, it doesn't seem the bond market is signaling a more systemic economic event is in the cards. That what we are living through, while very, very unpleasant, is more a significant repricing of risk assets and not the beginning of a credit or economic shock like we saw 12 or 13 years ago. And then finally, P is for policy. Policy help has come, and we think it will continue to come. As we all know, the Fed cut interest rates last week, intra-meeting, and the federal government approved an $8 billion plus coronavirus rescue package. We do expect more activity and more meaningful activity on the monetary policy and fiscal policy fronts. The Fed is likely to cut rates again over the coming days, as well as at its mid-March meeting. And we do expect to see much more from Washington, D.C. on fiscal policy, including possible assistance for airlines and energy companies and healthcare providers, those parts of the economy most hit by the impact of the coronavirus, and also for consumers, especially those folks struggling with near-term healthcare expenses. And we expect that domestic policy response, along with steps from non-U.S. actors, including central banks and governments and the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, among others, to help put a floor under risk assets and also set the stage for reacceleration and economic growth. Finally, before handing it over to Daniel, you know, I would state that volatile markets are never fun, but market history shows that drawdowns are part and parcel of investing. And the S&P 500 has corrected about 15% intra-year every year for the last three decades, while still giving us all about 10 to 11% per year in average annualized returns. Market history also shows that moving away from risk assets due to a health-related concern like the coronavirus is not a prudent move. These types of risks either dissipate reasonably quickly on their own or are successfully addressed by governmental and non-governmental institutions. And as we all try and navigate these very difficult times, we think we can best serve ourselves and our clients by keeping our focus on what ultimately drives the economy and the markets, and that would be monetary policy, fiscal policy, and the consumer. And for now, all remain supportive of growth and of risk assets. So with that said, I would like to turn the call over to Dr. Daniel Crosby, our Chief Behavioral Officer, who will speak to how our financial advisor partners can best work with clients, really best help clients navigate this very difficult environment. Daniel?
Yeah, thanks so much, Tim and Jeff. I'm going to take a 2-3-4 approach to my conversation today. I'm going to talk about two overarching points that I think are sort of a cultural or emotional commitment during tough times like this. I want to talk about three things that I think every investor needs. And then for the advisors on the call, I want to talk about four specific ways to speak to clients in a way that advice will stick. So first, I want to talk about these two overarching points, because I've often given a lot of tactical advice on how to give advice that sticks. That's important. We'll get to that. But I think that there's a few things that we need to keep in mind as sort of umbrella constructs when we're going through hard times like this. And the first of these things is empathy. So this is empathy with ourselves if we're an individual investor, and empathy for our clients if we are a financial advisor, because times like this are tough. And I think that we have to own that. We have to own how difficult these things are. We have to own that it's tough. That doesn't mean we have to act on it. I mean, that doesn't have to mean that we have to act against our own self-interest, to panic or to be foolish. But I think that we're fooling ourselves if we don't have a little bit of empathy for ourselves and for our clients, and just recognize that, you know, the rational or irrational conversation aside, days like this are tough and days like this are scary. And I think that paradoxically, owning that they can be a little scary and a little tough is the first step to not giving in to that scariness. The second thing that I would say, again, whether you're an end investor or an advisor, I think self-care is enormously important at times like this. You know, I wrote in The Behavioral Investor about how things that seem mundane or trivial, like how much sleep you got the night before, or whether or not you had exercised or what you had had to eat, actually these seemingly small, inconsequential things actually have a huge impact on the way that we make financial decisions. And so one of the most powerful things we can be doing for ourselves and for our clients right now is just taking care of ourselves, you know, avoiding alcohol and caffeine in excess, making sure we're exercising, making sure we're getting enough sleep. These things are very powerful. One statistic that I think a lot of people are unaware of is that 93% of financial advisors showed some form of mental illness, depression, anxiety, and even signs of PTSD in and around the great financial crisis. So days like this really, really do take their toll, and it's more important than ever that we take care of ourselves en route to being able to take care of our clients as well. So on to the three. I want to talk about three E's of behavior change. And anyone who has, you know, made a New Year's resolution, mine all seem very, very distant at this point in the face of all of this. But anyone who's made a New Year's resolution can attest to how hard it is to try and change your behavior, to develop new habits. And because it's so difficult to do the right thing or to make the appropriate behavioral changes, we really have to tackle this in a multimodal, a multi-front way. And so I have three E's that help us get there, and they are education, environment, and encouragement. So the first thing that we need if we're going to be sound behavioral investors is we need the right education. Now, this is where I think Tim and Jeff have been a great benefit to you today. You know, they talked about things like the fact that the market's down around 17%. I was moving pretty fast when I was putting this together, but it's down roughly 17% peak to trough this year, which is pretty typical. I mean, as Tim said, the average intra-year drawdown is only 15%. Now, if you're educated, if you're a market historian, you know things like this. But if you're just watching the news, you would think that, you know, moves like this, a 17% down peak to trough year, is entirely unprecedented in the history of the world, and yet we've gotten 15% drawdowns on average every year for the last 40 years. And so being educated helps put all of this in context. Many of the people that are weighing in on the news are purveyors of sensationalism. They have a vested interest in getting you to panic and to tune in. You can bet that there will be all sorts of panic-driven specials on tonight. But if you're truly educated and you're a market historian, none of this seems quite as scary. So that's sort of the first step. The second step is the environment, which is ensuring that we have the optimal portfolio. And when we say optimal, we don't mean optimized for returns. We mean optimized for anxiety-adjusted returns. Because the optimal portfolio in a vacuum and the optimal portfolio that you can live with and actually take the ride on are very, very, very different considerations. You know, I wrote about one study in one of my books that looked at the best performing mutual fund of the early 2000s and found that the average investor in the best performing mutual fund actually lost money. Because even though they had you know picked the right horse, so to speak, it had been so volatile that most people had not been able to take the ride and had been in and out of the fund at all the wrong times. So the right environment is being tested right now. And if you or your clients are unable to stick with the ups and downs that we're seeing right now, then that's information that environment might not be correct. But in addition to that education, we need that right environment, which is that right asset allocation. And then thirdly, and most importantly, is encouragement. Even if we have a sensible portfolio, even if we know intellectually that these things occur, as I said earlier, these things are tough. And we need someone to keep us on the straight and narrow, to hold our hand, to keep us sensible on days like today that sort of test our mettle. And so I think for most folks, this is the most important value that an advisor adds. And so I think it's more important than ever that advisors be proactive in reaching out to folks. And I think that even end investors need an outlet. They need a coach. They need an advisor. They need someone who can keep their head on straight when everything in them is screaming to sell. So I'm confident that if we have all these three things and if we're providing these three things to our clients, we're going to maximize their tendency to stick with it. But I want to build on this. I promised you a 2-3-4. So with this four conversation, I want to give four pillars for having hard conversations. So when we're in the act of, either encouraging ourselves, talking ourselves into doing the right thing, or talking to our clients about staying the course, there's four things that we can do. And they're actually some W words, some question words. It's why, what, who, and how. So first, I always encourage people to begin with why. Again, whether you're an end investor or you're an advisor that's counseling end investors, the simple act of reminding ourselves of why we are doing this is enormously, enormously powerful. It decreases the likelihood of cashing out by two-thirds. It increases compliance with a plan by 50%. So a lot changed today. You know, the markets changed. Our understanding of COVID-19 and the oil market, all these things changed today. But what likely did not change is your goals, your visions, and your dreams for the future. And if you did this right, all of this, you know, days like today were baked in the cake. Days like today were foreseen when you put together that plan, when you structured that asset allocation. So if your dreams haven't changed, if your goals haven't changed, your approach shouldn't change either. And so one of the most powerful things that we can do is just recenter ourselves and our clients on the bigger reasons why we're doing this. Because at times, again, when everything inside us is screaming no, we need to have a yes. We need to have a dream that's bigger than our fear. The second thing is what. So once we have sort of recentered ourselves or our clients around our goals and the reason that we're doing this, we again need to understand the what, which is going back to that education piece. We need to understand that this is how markets operate. You know, we are still up. If you back up a little bit, if you take a few steps back, we are still up at the 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, and 10 year marks. And everyone will tell you that they're a long-term investor. But when we have days like this, it becomes easy to get myopic. So again, with the what, we need to educate ourselves and our clients about the way that markets work and the reason why equity markets, as Tim and Jeff talked about, the reason why equity markets have been so rewarding historically is precisely because they are so scary. This is just how it works. And we get big moves. We get 5% moves on average a couple of times a year, about 1% of the time. And so it's not as unusual as all that, again, once you're an educated investor, once you have a deeper understanding of how markets work. So the third part of, again, keeping ourselves and our clients grounded is understanding who approves of the approach that we are undertaking. When it comes to the approach that we espouse here at Brinker, a multi-asset class investment approach that's undergird by behavioral finance from a planning and goals-based perspective. Who is behind this? Well, Nobel Prize-winning research is behind this. You know, our whole investment framework is built on a Nobel Prize-winning framework, and all of my work in the Behavioral Innovations Lab is based on the work of me standing on the shoulders of giants who have won 3 different Nobel Prizes. So if we're talking about staying the course, diversifying, playing the long game, there's a lot of smart people that agree with that. Now, on the other hand, who is putting out messages to the contrary? Well, the people who are putting out messages to the contrary are, you know, people who are selling newsletters, people who are selling clicks and eyeballs on news sites. And so it pays to consider the source, you know, who are sort of the intellectual lights behind each approach, whether it be staying the course or panicking. And I think that you would agree that the intellectual lights behind the approach that we're advocating here sort of win the day. So if you're an advisor and you're listening to this call, it can be hard at times like this to feel confident, because if we're honest with ourselves, there's a lot that we really don't know. I mean, we don't know what the market will do tomorrow, or, you know, even 1 week or 1 month from now. We just frankly don't know. And if we're being honest with ourselves and our clients, we have to tell them that we don't know what the spread of the disease will or will not look like. But what we do know is that people who tilt probability in their favor by following the kind of Nobel Prize winning research upon which that we're advocating for here have tended to do far better in the long term than people who've tried to time the market or panic. So be confident about what you can be confident about, which is the research pedigree, the intellectual pedigree of what you're espousing here, is something you can be confident in. You can be confident in the process, even when you can't be confident perhaps in the day-to-day particulars. And then, of course, all of this raises the final question, which is how, you know, what do I do now, knowing these things? There's a couple of things that I think that we can do. And I think it's important that we give ourselves or our clients something to do, because understandably, there is a profound action bias at times like this. You know, it's very easy for us to say, and it's right to even say, you know, the easiest thing, the best thing for you to do is to do nothing. But that's very, very hard for people to do in a time of felt fear or felt crisis. So there's a couple of things that we can do. The first thing to do is for folks who are just absolutely inconsolable, people who demand to do something, you know, I would encourage them to do a little something, to sin a little bit, as it were. Because if people insist on putting 2-4% in cash or becoming slightly more conservative, perhaps that's a pardonable offense at a time like this. But what we want to do is make sure that folks don't wholesale liquidate or don't go to cash. because folks who did that 10 years ago, or I guess 11 years ago to the day, is when the market bottomed out. The folks who did that, you have to make two decisions. You have to decide when to come out and when to come back in. And most people just do a very, very poor job of that. So if you have to act, or if your clients have to act, let's try and contain the damage. I think another thing that we can do is to recenter ourselves on timeless principles and on some of the best books and the best writing out there on behavioral finance and on the way that markets work. You know, I would certainly recommend to you any of the works that we've had our hand in at Brinker Capital. So The Laws of Wealth, The Behavioral Investor, Personal Benchmark, my book with Chuck Widger. Also encourage you to read or to suggest to your clients books by people like Carl Richards, people like Nick Murray, who very eloquently convey to clients and to ourselves how sensible it is to do the right thing at a time like this. You know, another thing we can do is we can put in crash bids. This is what I call them. I like to buy individual names at times that I feel like I missed on the way up. Stocks that may have gotten too expensive, but businesses that I love, I use, I know, and that I would love to be an owner of. It can be fun to put in an order for those, and in a way, even root for the market to drop to a point where we might feel good about owning those again. And then for the very courageous among us, we can, you know, laugh in the face of danger by upping our 401k contributions, maxing out our SEP IRA or 529 contributions, and getting in at a bargain price. And then finally, again, consistent with my self-care admonition early, channel some of that nervous energy into pursuing a hobby, spending time with loved ones, getting outdoors, getting some sunshine, getting some exercise. Replacement behaviors are very effective at a time like this. And I think we need something to help us take our minds off of what we've likely all been staring at on the screen all day. So in closing, Josh Brown wrote a great article today talking about days like this, and he called this the Super Bowl for financial advisors. And so for any of the financial advisors who are listening to this today, I hope you know that we at Brinker Capital know that you do important work. We believe that you're capable of greatness, and we know that days like this are when you add the most value to your clients' lives. They may be the days where you feel discouraged or beat down, but these are the days when you are doing the most good in the world, and we want to be your partner in that endeavor. And that's why we have calls like this. So whatever we can do to help, we want to be a partner as you play in your own personal Super Bowl. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks and turn it back to Ed.
Thank you, Daniel, and Jeff and Tim, thank you for your insights today, and thank all of you for joining the call. We hope that we addressed some of your concerns and you walk away with a better understanding of the current market environment and our thinking. A few additional items. To stay up to date with our latest thinking on market activity, behavioral finance, and technology, I encourage you to go to our website and click on our insights page and sign up for that update. And also, if you have any questions, please contact a member of your dedicated Brinker team. We look forward to our continued partnership in 2020. Thank you for the call and have a great day.